From the Carver Center for Public Radio, this is 91.3 KUAF, where you can hear great music every weekend with shows like The Generic Blues Show with Paul Kelso, Shades of Jazz with Robert Ginsburg, and Ozark Highlands Radio. For a complete schedule of all of our programs, check out KUAF.com. And this is Ozarks at Large for Friday, August 11th, 2017. I'm Kyle Kellums. On today's show, we honor the beginning of the school year. Next week for many public school districts, and later this month for most area colleges and universities. We'll honor this by listening to some interviews, stories, and music that are connected to those schools and the school season. Our usual Friday conversation with Michael Tilley from Talk Business and Politics is taking the week off, but Michael will be back with me next Friday. And 2 weeks from today, our annual live broadcast as part of the Fayetteville Roots Festival, originating from the Walker Community Room at the Fayetteville Public Library. We'll have 2 hours of great live entertainment, including live music from Elephant Revival and more. The show is free, on the air, and at the library, 2 weeks from today. Now we begin this edition of A Friday Ozarks with a conversation we first aired in January. The University of Arkansas Honors College offers students a chance to enroll in special signature seminar courses each semester. These courses are designed to allow students from across disciplines an opportunity to hear some of the top educators and researchers on campus lecture about topics that are related to their specialty. In January, we heard from Charles Robinson, the University of Arkansas's Vice Chancellor for Student Affairs and a professor of history. He gave us a preview of his class beginning this fall called Race, Rediscovered, Unresolved. When he talked to us this winter, he explained the idea for the course was not born out of the then-just-completed election of 2016.
Some people might think that this class was born of the Trump ascension, but it was not. It was actually born as a result of Obama's success back in 2008, because it was in after that success that the whole question of post-racialism really came to the public scene. People were questioning, I mean, pundits, have we reached a point where race no longer matters? And I can remember being an academic who's looking at issues tied to race and thinking, of course race continues to matter, that Obama's victory did not signal in any way that race had lost its relevance to American life and society. And but I was amazed at the number of people and pundits who really not only raised the question, but suggested very strongly that we were moving to very clearly to a day when race would no longer matter.
I don't mean this to be an elegant question, but how many of those pundits were white?
The vast majority of them were. And I think it's easier when you are either, and this was the one time when some white liberals and conservatives agreed. And I think the white liberals wanted to believe that we were progressing, you know, King's dream was becoming a reality. I can even remember some people suggesting that we needed to stop singing We Shall Overcome and change the words to We Have Overcome because of Obama's success. And Obama contributed to it to some extent, too. You know, yes, we can, and those types of, you know, slogans. And he made comments to the effect that we were going to get there. And even though I think he said in one quote that it might not happen in 4 years, we were going to get there. And that place seemed to suggest a place where race was no longer a negative to people's opportunity or the perception of opportunity. And so that's really where this whole notion of race, you know, rediscovered, unresolved, was born. And in seeing Trump and listening to him and the issues surrounding his rise, I thought, oh, this is absolutely the time to have a discourse about, you know, this type of issue. But it's really an old, a very old, old issue that, you know, continues to plague American society in many ways.
I don't want to oversimplify, but I mean, since Plymouth Rock, right? I mean, or soon after?
Absolutely. Yes. You know, the introduction of slavery to the colonies was clearly a factor in making race relevant in American life in ways that, you know, probably no one could have predicted. But yes, it's a colonial issue for sure. The Europeans brought over some, you know, attitudes about race, but they weren't hardened in the way that they would be by the experience of being in America, dealing with the institution of slavery, trying to justify it, rectify it with old English tendons that are, you know, tied to the equality of people. That's why America has grappled with this for a very long time.
How do you begin to do this examination in this symposium with students, chronologically, geographically?
I mean, well, I'm a historian, so we're definitely going back. I think too many people talk about this in the vacuum of the now, the contemporary time. And you have to go back. And when you go back and you examine it, it doesn't seem all that odd. It seems pretty predictable and consistent with the way we've operated. What has, I think, changed is how we perceive it as a nation. Like, you know, it's no longer just a black-white dynamic, which is you know, evolution and change to a certain extent, but it is still a dynamic in which something that is really a social construct that has no anatomical meaning, yet, you know, affects so much of how we see the world and how the world sees people. And I think understanding the historical origins, definitely going back to colonial times, looking at the institution of slavery and how that shaped American ideas and positions on race, how Southerners would fight for slavery to keep slavery prior to the Civil War, and then shortly thereafter say that it had nothing to do with slavery. You know, it makes me think of the issue of immigration today, that, you know, that there would be people who would say that Trump's ascension had nothing to do with racism, had nothing to do with an anti-immigration stance, that it's about putting America first, because people generally don't like to be associated with oppressive ideas. So they make attempts to change language to make that language more acceptable and suggest that this is tied to something that's less barbaric or less mean-spirited than the notion of than some other notion. So
this conversation, like many other big topics, people often bring the anecdotal, the personal.
Sure.
And, well, I feel this or I've experienced this. And sometimes it's hard to step back.
Sure.
And, you know, look at from colonial times to redlining of neighborhoods and things like that. Sure. Will you facilitate discussion during this?
Oh, I hope to, you know, have most of the class that is tied to discussion. I want the students to explore for themselves and not just have me narrate, history and experiences. And I really want to get their thoughts and their, you know, have them share their experiences. And I'll share mine. But I think to go through and talk about some of those factual occurrences, some of those historical changes or the consistency relative to issues of race and inclusion and systemic realities is something that you have to do, because if you do it, then what you see now doesn't seem really all that unusual. And I think that puts things in perspective. American society has always been one in which we've had dreams. I mean, King wasn't the first one to dream. He articulated in a way. I mean, I think Jefferson was dreaming when he said, "We hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal." What is he talking about? He's in a society in which he personally owned slaves. That's a dream. And so Americans are, you know, historically have been dreamers. And I think we're still dreaming of the type of society we want to be. But getting there is a much more difficult thing.
Well, you mentioned that people do not like to be part of an oppressive movement. There is a real challenge for many to, on one hand, understand what the founding fathers did, creating this country. But on the other hand, grapple with the fact that they did it for white
males,
white landowning men.
That's right.
And that's, you know, so if these are heroes,
yes.
And I don't want to get into presentism, but
right.
But for a lot of Americans, I think that's a tough inner conversation to have that many people just then decide not to have.
Absolutely. I mean, the 4th of July is a great example of that very type of issue. 4th of July is a day we associate with freedom and, you know, justice for all, the birth of a nation that would become the leader of truth and justice and human rights. Well, I mean, July 4th, 1776 was far from that. I mean, for people of color. And it was far from that for white women, people who were landless. So, yes, we like to create a narrative that fits into this notion that America has always been a place, that a nation that supported truth and justice, God's country. But the reality the facts are often very different. And trying to grapple with that emotionally, how to make that, you know, I think it was Frederick Douglass who asked the question, what is the meaning of the 4th of July to a black man, you know, and that's a great question, or to a slave.
Yeah.
Right.
And we need to have these conversations.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's the beauty of higher education. We can have a conversation, I think, in safe spaces where people feel that they can voice their thoughts and we can learn not what the professor necessarily thinks, but what other scholars think, you know, reveal to us in their research, and then try to make sense of it all. I think understanding American history and really appreciating it is understanding that we have a history of that's a mixed baggage of, you know, hope and opportunity, repression and brutality. And all of that makes us who we are today. And I think if you look in the mirror and you say, this is what we've been, you have a better chance of trying to really reach the goal that you think you want to see this nation reach as a people. You cannot deny the harsh reality and hope to ever grow and evolve into something better. And I think that's the beauty of studying history. I always tell my classes in college, my courses are rated R. And what that means that I keep it real. I'm telling you what, you know, is these are factual things that I'm revealing, but also try to make it relevant. Why does this matter? And hopefully in this course, we'll be able to achieve this R rating in a way that students can really walk away with understanding, better understanding, and I guess have a better sense of what they believe is the best way to look at the dynamic of our present state.
Have you thought about the thin ice that's possible in these discussions? You want passion, but, you know, you don't want...
My job as a facilitator is to try to ensure that everyone's voice is respected and heard. I've taught history for... over two decades. And so I feel like I have some experience in doing that. I think students think they can predict where I'm going to be on issues, but I intentionally play the devil's advocate because I think it's important to get people thinking. And I don't want them to walk away with my thoughts. I want them to walk away thinking about the issues that we discuss and, you know, assessing whether or not they agree, disagree, or what can be done to ameliorate conditions and move forward.
You may have some young people in this who, because of where they grew up or lived, haven't really had much interaction with people who don't look like them.
Absolutely.
And that's another thing that a big land-grant university can do.
Absolutely. Bringing people together. I mean, it's possible for me to have students who've never had an African-American professor. I've been told that by students that I've taught, you know, in my time here. I was the first, you know, teacher of color that they've had. And that in and of itself, it's its own experience. And so any way that I can contribute to learning and you know, in a positive way, educating young people, I mean, that's our purpose at the university. And I hope that this class will contribute to their development in a way that's positive.
Is it responsible at all for someone to talk about a post-racial world on the near horizon? I mean, history would suggest that it's not happening real soon.
Well, it depends on what we mean by post-racial. I mean, post-racial can be, well, we really want to get beyond some of the most challenging racial problems. Not that we want to erase race. I mean, that is a question. Is the goal really to erase race or to get beyond some of the issues, challenges that are tied to the issue of race? And I think that's something that needs to be grappled with by people and students and leaders. So post-racial, I guess it depends on your meaning. I still hold out hope that we can deal with the most egregious challenges that are tied to race. And we can definitely deal with them more effectively than we are doing now. In that sense, that could move us towards a certain type of post-racialism. But in terms of getting beyond the impact of race or the effect that race has on people's consciousness, I'm not sure we want to do that. I'm not sure that we want to erase the importance that race and it's tied to culture and the opportunities to learn relative to diversity and making us all more diversity literate. I'm not sure we want to get beyond, I mean, get to a society that's that way. That might be rather boring.
Well, but thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Charles Robinson is the University of Arkansas's Vice Chancellor for Student Affairs and a professor of history. This fall, he's teaching an Honors College signature seminar titled Race Rediscovered, Unresolved. And later on today's Ozarks, another preview of a signature seminar class. Matt Waller, the dean of the Sam M. Walton Business College at the U of A, talks to us about his course involving the history of business innovation in Arkansas. And this fall, next month actually, you'll have an opportunity to hear from three highly respected U of A scholars previewing seminars they'll teach during the spring semester. September 6th, Josh Smith will offer a public lecture about his course on how manuscripts were created before the printing press. During that course, he's going to use some items from the University of Arkansas Library Special Collections. On September 13th, Todd Cleveland will discuss his spring course, Soccer, about the influence the game has had on the world and vice versa. And on September 20th, Stephanie Schulte will deliver a public preview of her course on the Internet. All three lectures begin at 5:15 p.m. in Gerhardt Hall Auditorium. All are free and open to the public. And finally, each of the three will also be in the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio in the coming weeks to talk to us. This is Ozarks at Large.
Did your high school science classes sound something like this?
Water molecule is polar with a partial negative charge on the oxygen
but
atom.
But what if those classes sounded like this?
Things get really horrible as his skin rips apart and he sees a virus coming out from his insides.
I'm Guy Raz. Ideas about changing education, next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
The TED Radio Hour, Sunday afternoons at 1 on 91.3 KUAF.
91.3 KUAF is supported by Highlands Oncology Group. Highlands Oncology's cancer specialists provide comprehensive, collaborative care, allowing patients and families to stay close to home. With locations in Benton and Washington counties, Highlands Oncology is helping patients fight the battle every day. HighlandsOncologyGroup.com. The Northwest Arkansas Jazz Society and KUAF Summer Jazz Concert Series continues with Six Strings, Six Stories, tracing the lineage of the jazz guitar with the Alex Wentz Trio, Saturday, August 19th at 8 p.m. at the Haxton Road Studio in Bentonville. KUAF.com or digjazz.com for information or tickets.
The Heartland Conference is an NCAA Division II conference consisting of 10 schools in Arkansas, Kansas, Oklahoma, and Texas. Founded in 1999, it's one of the newest NCAA Division II conferences, and beginning this fall, the organization will have a brand new logo thanks to a University of Arkansas Fort Smith student. Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda has more.
The Nike swoosh, Apple's half-eaten apple, McDonald's golden arches. All of these logos are instantly recognizable to consumers. But do you know who actually designed them? Not always being well-known for your creations is the trade-off you make when becoming a graphic designer like Talia Blanton, a senior at the University of Arkansas Fort Smith.
It's one of those silent careers where it's just you can feel proud of it, but no one else is going to know that it was you. I mean, even music, you know, people know who artists are, they know their names, but when it comes to design, you see these things every day and will never know who that person is, and sometimes you can't even find it on the internet.
During her career, Blanton may have relative anonymity for her designs, but right now she's receiving recognition for redesigning the logo for the Heartland Conference, the conference in which UAFS athletes compete. Blanton and seven other students were tasked with designing an updated logo as part of a class assignment. Conference officials visited the students and discussed what they were looking for in a new emblem.
Here are things we like, here are things we don't like, and here's our tenets and our goals, and go at it. You know, we want to be modern. We feel that our current branding is outdated, so they wanted something fresh, something new, and something that could last a lot longer because this is the digital age and all that. So, you know, everything's sleek and things like that.
The ideas of progress and moving forward resonated most with Blanton, and those concepts guided her as she created her logo.
We had like a leveled process. We had, you know, everyone made one, then they picked the best four, and then we all went at it again with suggestions from them, and then sent those into them, and then they contacted me and said that I was the one out of the four. So that's really just how it went. It was just like a, what's it called? Whenever, it's just like the conference itself. You know, you have so many teams, they all compete, and then you get down to the finals, and then, you know, there's a winner. So that's really how the same exact thing that happened, which is kind of funny, I guess. It's like a mirror effect.
Because she's not super athletic, Blanton says she was surprised her design was chosen.
I am probably the least athletic person in that room. the most exercise I get is walking to the restroom or something like that. So I kind of had the least idea. And, you know, the girl sitting behind me, she was a volleyball player. She played in the Heartland Conference. So it's like she's going to obviously have the best ideas and things like that. But in the end, it's, you know, it's up to the client.
While the recognition for her work on the logo may die down soon, this whole process has provided Blanton with real-world experience and a boost to her confidence.
It's still cool because, you know, even if no one else does. So that's one of the biggest things. You kind of sacrifice your work to whoever needs it. And it's great. I can't wait to see things with it on it. I guess that's the best part, is just seeing things you make come to life.
The new Heartland Conference logo is scheduled to be released this fall. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
On this Ozarks, we're considering the return this month of students to schools, colleges, and universities all over our region. Arkansas education officials estimate that each day during the school year, more than 1,000 school buses with an extended stop sign and red lights flashing are illegally passed by other vehicles. That's why Jerry Owens with the Arkansas Department of Education says they're launching a 3-week campaign to raise awareness about school bus safety.
There have been accidents where there have been fatalities, and one is just too many. So we just have to, first of all, when we see a school bus, we should slow down instantly. But when we see these flashing red lights, we know this is caution. The flashing red lights are there for a reason, and it means students are crossing the road and students are getting ready to get on that school bus.
Owen says the estimate of 1,000 illegal passes of school buses per school day in Arkansas is based on a recent survey.
We had 706 incidents of motorists passing a stopped school bus with flashing red going off. That means students were getting on the bus, and this is, again, with just half of the school district reporting. So we know the numbers are well over 1,000 motorists a day pass a school bus with these flashing red lights on, and this is alarming.
Legislation passed in 2005 named Isaac's Law after a student killed in an accident increased the fines and punishment for anyone who illegally passes a stopped school bus. Owen says in the coming weeks, some local law enforcement agencies will be monitoring school buses to look for any violations.
It's the Community Spotlight on KUAF. My name is Pete Hartman. Today we're in the Furman Garner Performance Studio because we need more than just two microphones. We have a couple of people here with us today from the Northwest Arkansas Center for Sexual Assault. We're speaking with Allison Nail, Board Vice President. Allison, thanks for coming up.
Yeah, thank you so much.
And Ann Shelley, the Executive Director of the Center. Ann, thank you.
Pete, it's great to be here. Thanks for having us.
I thought we'd first talk about history of this entity before we get into what's going on currently.
Great.
How long has this center been around? And I know it's had at least another name.
Yeah, we were founded in 1983. We're in our 35th year currently. It was founded as Rape Crisis, Inc., Northwest Arkansas Rape Crisis, Inc. And so many people, some who are probably listening today, have had a hand in making sure that this was a reality for Northwest Arkansas survivors of sexual violence. Going back to the Women's Center at the University of Arkansas, I know some of, I probably forget some of the names, but Barbara Taylor and several other folks did this in their living rooms. I know Hillary Rodham Clinton had a hand in it when she was there and helped to start the Women's Center. A lot of caring, giving people in our community have put their energy into making sure that survivors of sexual violence have a place to go, where they are believed, where they are supported, and where their voice can be heard. And I'm actually honored to sit here in this chair across from you on the shoulders of those men and women who started this and say to you that we are so proud to be in our 35th year. Wow. And that's kind of why we wanted to launch our Survive to Thrive campaign, Survive to Thrive at 35.
Yeah, we're really excited about that and having an opportunity for our community to pour into our center to both bring awareness to the things that we do for our community, but also all the different services that are provided for our survivors as well as the people who support our survivors. So this is a really great opportunity to not only bring awareness, but for our community to really pour into the survivors and their families in the area.
Pre-1983. Were there centers like this that existed? Was this one of the first ones?
Well, that's a great question. In the state of Arkansas, there are only two standalone rape crisis centers that serve adult survivors. There are centers like our friends in Fort Smith that do domestic violence and sexual assault. But we are one of just two in the state and still a handful across the country. And if you look historically, about all of them started in the late 70s, early 80s, kind of on the wings of the women's movement at that time, where so many people were trying to get the issues that affect women into the forefront. And that said, though, we don't just serve women. There's several male survivors as well, and we're here to serve everyone. This really was founded on the understanding that we live in a society that creates a culture where perpetrators are supported more than victims, and victims are often blamed. And that's the one thing that we are up against so often when we work with survivors, is not only are they facing a society that kind of points the finger at them, but also they themselves then internalize those messages and believe it's their fault. So if nothing else, Pete, I would want anyone who's hearing this, especially those of us who are survivors ourselves, to know that you're not alone. It's not your fault. We will believe you and support you no matter whether the assault happened when you were a child or if it happened 5 minutes ago. We are here. Our commitment to the community is to stay here, and we're hoping the community will support us in this campaign so that we have the means and the stability to do so.
So typically, if you look in your circle of friends, a minimum of, if you counted one, two, three, that third person has been sexually assaulted. At the very least, they know somebody who has been. So whoever may be listening, I think that that was a big thing for me as well, having been a survivor as well. But even outside of myself, going through the people that I know, if I can count one, two, three, they know of or they have been sexually assaulted. So every single person listening will have known or will know somebody that has been affected by sexual assault.
Allison Nail and Ann Shelley of NWA Center for Sexual Assault. For more, NWASexualAssault.org.
Community Clinic will celebrate National Community Health Center Week. That's next week, with an event August 15th in Springdale. It will include Senator Chris Eads and Representative Jeff Williams, lawmakers instrumental in efforts to help the Marshallese children have access to our kids. For more on that event, NWASexualAssault.org. Also, if you or someone you know is looking for help with a sexual assault issue, the hotline, 800-794-4175. That's 800-794-4175. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. Happy Friday. This fall, Matt Waller, the dean of the Sam M. Walton Business College at the University of Arkansas, will lead a course for students enrolled in the U of A Honors College. The class examines the history of business innovation in Arkansas and is part of the Honors College Signature Seminar Series. In March, he came to the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio to talk to us about the course. Waller says there is a rich history of innovation here, but also a vibrant present.
There is so much going on here in terms of innovation. And the innovation that's occurred here has affected not only, you know, the retail and consumer products and supply chain industries, but it's affected many other industries throughout the world. And that's something I've paid attention to over the past 24 years.
What are some of the other industries that have been affected?
So I'll give you an example. Walmart, well, first of all, Walmart's idea of sharing sales data, which and also inventory data and many other types of data with their suppliers. The original idea behind it was that suppliers could forecast better and do a better job of serving the retailer. And here's a simple example. A supplier shipping product into a distribution center of a retailer, they're receiving orders from the retailer, and they know what they've shipped in, but they really don't know what's going on in the stores. So let's suppose that demand spikes at all the stores for a particular product that the supplier's providing. It could take quite a while before the supplier's aware of that without sharing data, because you have to deplete inventory in the store, and then as the store is depleting inventory, it starts ordering on the distribution centers. The inventory starts depleting in the distribution centers. Eventually, you hit a reorder point, and orders are placed on the supplier. But that gap could be quite long, sometimes a month, sometimes 2 months.
And you may have missed the window?
You may have missed it. So now you haven't produced enough to meet demand. You have stockouts. When there's stockouts, you know, shoppers don't like stockouts. Sometimes they'll switch retailers. Sometimes they'll switch brands. And if they switch retailers, even if it's just temporarily, it's not good for the economy. You're wasting resources. On the other hand, if demand slows way down, right, again, they don't know about it until it's like, why isn't the retailer placing orders? So they wind up with too much inventory. They produce too much. So you either have stockouts or too much inventory, and wasted transportation. So the consumer is worse off, the retailer's worse off, and the supplier's worse off. And Sam Walton and his team had the idea, gosh, if we share point-of-sale data, that is how much product is actually moving in the stores on a daily basis, plus how much inventory we have and other types of variables, then suppliers can do a better job of making decisions, and we'll all be better off. Costs will be lower, and product will be in stock. That was the original idea. But I want to mention that this course isn't just about Walmart. It's really about Arkansas business. Because what we see, there's stories like this about Tyson and J.B. Hunt and Stevens. And so just as an example, yeah, we have the largest, in Arkansas, we have the largest retailer in the world. We have the largest protein producer in the world, Tyson. We have one of the largest and most innovative transportation providers and logistics providers in the world, and J.B. Hunt. But Arkansas also has the largest investment bank outside of Wall Street, Stevens Inc. It's the largest investment bank outside Wall Street. And there's an important point here that people don't realize, and that is Stevens took J.B. Hunt public in 1970. Right. Stevens took Walmart public in 1970. Stevens took J.B. Hunt public in 1983. But I believe, and I don't have any proof of this, but my opinion is that both of them would have had trouble going public on Wall Street without Stevens. And here's a simple reason why. Think about why did Walmart by 1970 start needing capital? Well, because of their strategy. Their strategy was to use distribution centers, which had never been done before on a large-scale basis in retail, use distribution centers to serve stores. And the purpose of it was to reduce transportation costs, because instead of having small shipments go into a store from all these different, you know, suppliers, you wind up having consolidated truckloads going to the DC. They're homogeneous truckloads of one product, say Bounty paper towels, for example. They're going to the DC, but then when they ship from the DC to the stores, they have full truckloads of a mixture. You know, you have Bounty products, you have Tide, you have products from all different companies going to a store. So the point is, you've got full truckloads the whole way, and it makes it extremely efficient. It also the distribution center is closer to the stores, so if demand picks up in the store, they can place an order on the DC, and they've got just a couple of days to get the product. Whereas if they were ordering directly from the factory, from the store,
it could take
a couple of weeks, right, potentially.
And when you say DC, that's the distribution center.
Yeah, distribution center.
So is this a random roll of the dice that you would have someone like Sam Walton, who's looking beyond, and you have Jack and Whit Stevens, who are building this bank? Is it completely random, and they all sort of end up in this same small state? Or does something else a little bit exist that it's not just random?
I really think it isn't random. Now, you know, again, these companies needed – I mean, Stevens has taken so many companies in Arkansas public and helped them in other ways financially. Having access to capital is critical for business development. People don't understand how critical that is, actually. So having Stevens in Arkansas has given Arkansas an advantage. But back to your question about the visionary leaders that we've had, I mean, right? Mm-hmm. Walton, Tyson, Hunt, these were visionary leaders. And Jack and Whit Stevens, visionary leaders. And there's many others. You know, Dillard's and Axiom had them, ABF, American Freightways, Sheridan Garrison, which is now FedEx Freight, which is the largest LTL carrier, less than truckload carrier in the United States. Think about that. We've got, you know, J.B. Hunt, one of the most innovative logistics providers. We have ABF, one of the top LTL providers, and we have FedEx Freight, which is from Harrison. It was Arkansas Freightways, then it was American Freightways, now it's FedEx Freight. That's the largest LTL carrier in the United States. I don't think it is random. Access to capital is very important. Stevens has provided that. But I actually think sometimes scarcity, right? Mm. Scarcity creates innovation. If you look at Hong Kong, Hong Kong's a rock. It has no natural resources. And yet, you know, by 1980, the wealth of Hong Kong was orders of magnitude higher than all of the wealth of China, and it's just a rock. But because it was a rock, it had to be very innovative. It had a lot of freedom, too. Right. And I think Arkansas, we're landlocked. We don't have access to the ocean. There's a lot of natural resources that we really don't have. And, you know, people will say, gosh, all these transportation providers cropped up in Arkansas. They must have good transportation. Actually, until recently, we didn't even have interstates through the state.
Yeah, J.B. Hunt was going out on Highway 71 for crying out loud. Yeah.
So it really wasn't even the infrastructure. But they had vision, and they had to do something to compete. And, you know, Sam Walton's idea, of course, of serving rural community, which wasn't being served, so he saw market need, using distribution centers, which made for efficiency, because he really thought logistics and supply chain were important. And then collaborating with suppliers. These were innovative ideas, I think, that were necessary for success. I want to take J.B. Hunt as an example. J.B. Hunt was in a business, right? They were in truckload. Truckload, sometimes it's called irregular route. And what it means is you're hired to take a product from a truckload from point A to point B. It may not be a full truckload, but it's truckload point A to point B. And when you get to point B, you try to find another load. And so you wind up going all over the country. Sometimes people aren't back for a month. It's almost a perfectly competitive business, meaning there isn't any profit in it because anyone can get into the business. The barriers to entry are low. There's no customer switching costs. There's no economies of scale, et cetera, et cetera. And yet, J.B. Hunt is a big company and extremely profitable. What happened? Well, what they did was they tried J.B. Hunt. One of his strengths was he would try lots and lots of different things. Some would work and some wouldn't, but he kept trying new things. But eventually, some of the things he tried, like intermodal,
right,
which is where you take a truck and you bring it to the rail yard and you take the container off of the back off the chassis off the truck, put it on a rail car, and take it across the country, and then it's picked up again for delivery with a truck. That's so much more efficient than sending a truck across the country.
And it's a standard term now.
Exactly.
Yeah,
and it's better for the drivers; they get home more often on time. And but J.B. Hunt really realized that, and I won't go into all the innovations, but it took lots of innovations to make that work. Intermodal had been around a long time, but making it feasible for most companies was the trick. So it's another innovation, and now other carriers are trying to copy what J.B. Hunt's doing there, but it's going to take a long time for anyone to catch up.
It's incredible. I mean, we, those of us who live in Arkansas, Northwest Arkansas, don't know as much as we should. Do people in, I don't know, Peoria or Flagstaff, do they know?
I don't think they do. I mean, when you really look at, and I mean, I've just scratched the surface. There's a lot of other innovative companies here in Arkansas. But I don't think people outside of Arkansas know about it. I don't think we've done a good job of communicating it to the rest of the world. But I think that that's part of the reason I wanted to teach this course. I thought, at the very least, our students should be aware of what's going on. And we're also going to talk about theoretical reasons why this happened.
Oh, good.
Right? You know, what is the theory that would predict this to occur, both from, you know, maybe economic theory and also from management theory. And I'm going to have some other professors helping me with that as well. But you look at Central Little Rock, Central Arkansas and Little Rock, again, there's a whole lot of entrepreneurial activity going on there. And it seems there's a number of companies that seem to really be taking. But I think there's one big opportunity here for us in Arkansas that could easily be overlooked. Northwest Arkansas has a number of startups right now. One example would be Good Eats.
Good Eats.
It's in Fayetteville.
Okay.
Their headquarters is on Dixon Street.
Okay.
And they make, you know, like, if you want to have potatoes, instant potatoes, you take instant potatoes, you mix it with water, you cook it. They have something just like that, but say with cauliflower, right? Which can be better for you depending on what.
Sure, of course. Your arteries and, right, yeah.
Exactly. Right. So they've come out with a whole line of products like this. Why? Because Northwest Arkansas has a tremendous concentration of retail and consumer goods expertise.
So this can be exponential.
Absolutely.
Good Eats might not have been here if these other entities weren't here or hadn't come before.
I don't think they would be. They wouldn't be. And there's a lot of other companies. Another interesting example of, you think about this, Little Rock has a tremendous healthcare industry. You know, a tremendous research medical school. Northwest Arkansas has a tremendous consumer goods retail expertise. Combine those, right? You have consumer health care. This is something that's an opportunity that we have not fully taken advantage of. The only example I think of this is Now Diagnostics that I'm aware of. I don't know if you've heard of them.
No.
Now Diagnostics.
I'm just going to bring you in every week to give me story ideas. Go ahead.
Now Diagnostics has these cartridges where you can, like, check for pregnancy or certain kinds of illnesses. And their vision is that in the long run, you know, if you pick up your kid from school and they're sick, you could go to Walmart or wherever and buy some of these cartridges and say, okay, well, they don't have strep, they don't have the flu, you know, it's just a cold or something. But think of the implication of that from a cost perspective or for the medical industry.
For busy parents or single parents who don't have time to, or really would not rather have to go to the clinic to find out you just have a cold.
And one of the things we're doing in the Walton College is we're collaborating much more with UAMS now because there's a big opportunity for business and medicine. You know, the medical industry is in Little Rock. The consumer goods industry is in Northwest Arkansas. Bring them together. We have something you can't find anywhere in the world.
All right. I have one last question that has nothing to do with your class. But you were talking about supply chain. A couple weeks ago, I needed buttermilk for a recipe. I went to two separate grocery stores. They're never out of buttermilk. They were both out of buttermilk on this Sunday afternoon. And I'm thinking, how can that happen? I mean, is there any... Can people see trends? I mean, were we all of a sudden, all of us wanting to make cornbread or something? Right. I mean, what can cause that?
It is possible, but I'll give you two ways of looking at it. If you flip a coin, you know, 20 times, the probability of getting heads every time is low.
Right.
But it's possible. And it happens.
Right.
Right?
Right.
So that's one thing that could have happened. It could have been a random thing. But I remember when I moved here, I guess it was a few years after I'd been here. It was probably 1998. I met someone who lives in Rogers who has a really big house. And he invited my wife and I to a Christmas party. And he has this huge Christmas tree in his foyer. I couldn't figure out how he got it through the door. But he wrapped every branch with these lights, you know, white lights, mm-hmm. every branch. And I immediately thought he caused some stockout. So I said to him, I said, how did you buy enough lights for this tree? He said, well, we waited too long, and we went to every store in Northwest Arkansas and bought all their lights.
So someone might have been some event going on that needed – all the buttermilk.
It's possible.
I love that you went to a Christmas party and you were thinking about a stock out.
Yeah. But this is sort of a summary of some of the topics in my course. So that's why I'm excited about it. And I think it'll be good for our students to be aware of what's going on. So being able to take the theory they're learning in the courses and connect it to what's actually happened. But the other things they're going to get to do is they're going to get to meet these people. I'm going to have some of the founders of these companies come in and speak to our students. And even if they're not the founders, people that were involved in a big way. And then we'll have groups of students go to dinner with them and me. So we'll take groups, making sure that all the students are able to do this, so the students can actually network with these people and meet with them.
Matt Waller is the dean of the Sam M. Walton Business College at the University of Arkansas, and this fall he'll lead a course for students enrolled in the U of A Honors College about business innovation in Arkansas. Our conversation that we just heard first aired in March.
Teachers face an uphill struggle from low pay and large classes to a lack of autonomy.
We've just endured more and more cuts, so we're seeing a lack of resources at unprecedented levels.
And how high teacher turnover and low morale affects our kids.
You know, what does it mean in a school if a fifth to a quarter of the full-time teachers leave every school year?
Plus, the consequences for the country of an unequal education.
Inequality is the Achilles heel in American education, and that will, if not corrected, haunt this country for many decades to come.
That special hour from With Good Reason this Sunday at 3 p.m. on 91.3 KUAF.
On almost every Friday edition of Ozarks at Large, we include music recorded inside the Carver Center for Public Radio, often in the Furman Garner Performance Studio. Today, no different. And the band Goose fits into our back-to-school theme today because they'll be headlining the Back-to-School Bash at George's Majestic Lounge on Dixon Street on September 1st. It's an 18 and older show. This is Goose performing What Am I Running From, recorded in the Furman Garner Performance Studio.
One, two, one, two.
backseat, thinking of you. For a moment felt like home. Feeling restless, praying I find something new to take my mind off what's now gone. And I say, oh no, what did I do? I left everything I ever loved behind. That means you and I say, oh no, what have I done? Now that I'm finally standing still, I'm asking, what am I running from? What am I running from? Thought I'd like it, being on my own. Look around, nothing's familiar. Got your letters, don't know why I haven't picked up the phone. Afraid to think that I failed ya. And I say, oh no, what did I do? I left everything I ever loved behind. And that means you and I say, oh no, what have I done? Now that I'm finally standing still, I'm asking, what am I running from? What am I running from? What am I running from? Nothing is chasing me. I just keep going in circles, trying to avoid who I've become. This isn't who I want to be or who I wanted you to see. And I say, oh no, what did I do? I left everything I ever loved behind, and that means you, I say, what have I done? Now that I'm finally standing still, I'm asking, oh no, what did I do? I left everything I ever loved behind, and that means you, I say, oh no, what have I done? Now that I'm finally standing still, I'm asking, what am I running from? 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 What am I running from?
The band Goose performing the song What Am I Running From? That was recorded in the Furman Garner Performance Studio at the Carver Center for Public Radio. They will be part of the Back to School Bash at George's Majestic Lounge on September 1. It is an 18 and over show. This is Ozarks at Large.
On this week's On the Media, a woman's right to an abortion is enshrined in law. So why are we still discussing it?
These issues have been shaped by people with nakedly self-serving partisan interests. The political intensity of it, that's an artifice.
The overheated rhetoric of the abortion debate on the next On the Media from WNYC.
That's Sunday morning at 11 on 91.3. A service of the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. This is 91.3 KUAF, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, and Deer, home of the Antlers. Go Antlers. Ozarks at Large, a production of KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums. Thanks so much for listening and spending part of your Friday with us. A brand new edition of the Daily Ozarks at Large, Monday at noon and 7. Have a great weekend.